You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. We bring expertise on international affairs from Stanford's campus straight to you. I'm Michael McFaul, host of World Class and director of the Freeman Spogli Institute. Today we are talking to Professor Scott Sagan about the recent U.S.-North Korea summit in Hanoi, Vietnam. The summit failed to produce any agreement between the United States and North Korea on denuclearization. And today we're going to discuss why the summit collapsed and what it means for the North Korean threat and the prospect of future diplomacy. Professor Scott Sagan is a senior fellow here at the Freeman Spogli Institute and our Center for International Security and Cooperation. He's also a professor of political science at Stanford and the author of several books on nuclear strategy and security. And he's a good friend of mine. So it's great to have Scott here for the first time on World Class. Scott, thanks for joining us.
It's a real pleasure, Mike.
So let's start with the basics. What, in your view, were the reasons for the summit ending the way it did?
If you had asked me to talk to you just before the summit, I would have said, I think it's going to be a limited success. And I would say that for two basic reasons. One was that, as opposed to Singapore, where people went without much background preparation, for Hanoi, Steve Biegun had been appointed as a special envoy,
right,
had multiple trips to the region. Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, had come.
He had a trip here at Stanford, too, by the way.
Yeah, Biegun. And Biegun, when he was at Stanford,
tell us a little bit.
He announced that the administration was no longer going to take the position that all of North Korea's nuclear weapons had to be verifiably dismantled before the sanctions would end, that there'd be a step-by-step kind of approach. And that was big news.
That was big news.
The second reason why I thought that there was likely to be a limited agreement was that they had announced a signing ceremony at the end.
Right.
And that's a sign that the people had gotten really close. So what happened? Well, we now know two different stories. One is the administration's position and some private conversations that people have had that have been reported in David Sanger's work in the New York Times. And that's that they did not have the final agreement of a limited exchange, for example, to dismantle the Yongbyon reactor complex in exchange for some limited sanctions relief. That would be one limited option that could have been potentially one of the arguments. They didn't have that final, and the president said, I'm going to go anyway, and I'll be able to convince him on what one of Sanger's commentators said was the big deal.
The big deal.
We're going to go big, and we're going to get complete denuclearization for complete end of the sanctions. We'll agree to that.
And tell our listeners, that what does big mean in denuclearization?
Denuclearization would be not just taking one complex where
right.
we know that they have uranium enrichment, plutonium reprocessing,
right.
but to dig deeper into other places. We know that that's not the only place where they're making nuclear materials.
Right.
We suspect some sites, and we suspect there are some sites we really don't know about yet.
Okay.
And we presented those, apparently, at least what we do know about, at the Hanoi summit, and Trump said Kim was surprised at how much we knew. We don't know whether he was surprised that we don't know everything, but nonetheless...
Well, that's a good point.
But nonetheless, Kim did not bite for that.
Okay.
That's one explanation. The president was overambitious, didn't go for a smaller deal, didn't try to push... The other argument is that the North Koreans also went big, saying Trump needs an agreement for domestic reasons at home. He's fallen in love with me.
Right.
And so therefore, I will give up just the Yongbyon facility in exchange for all the sanctions relief. And Trump said no to that, said that's not enough.
That's not enough.
That's not enough. And from our perspective, we didn't want giving up the reactor facility at Yongbyon was not enough.
Right.
So there was a failure, and they canceled the summit or final ceremony.
And they didn't have a press conference together, just President Trump did it himself.
Correct.
So what happens next? What do you think is the next move in this negotiation?
That, too, is a mystery. Positive signs are that there are people in Washington who have been hinting, well, we're going to continue, and we'll have another set of meetings that we'll try at the lower levels to try out different compromises, different kinds of ways that we could have a limited deal as a first step towards complete denuclearization. And the North Koreans, quite understandably, in my view, argue that we're not going to get rid of all of our capability on the first date.
Right.
We want to see a change in relations with you, and over time, maybe we'll get that far. But no, we need to have some deterrent capability. On the negative side, you have a sign from overhead reconnaissance that the North Koreans are starting to put back together one of their missile test sites that they had started the dismantlement of. And so they've been...
After Singapore, right?
Yes.
Right. Okay. Correct. And now they're moving in...
They're moving in the opposite direction. So they may be getting ready to do some kinds of tests. They've had low-level missile tests, but not anything long-range.
And presumably they know that we know that they're doing that, right?
Yes.
So this is a signal to us?
Yes. And it could be a signal that you guys need to bargain with us, or it could be a signal that we're getting worried again, so we're going to improve our capabilities. So here's a big mystery. In January 2018, Kim Jong-un announced that we don't need any more missile tests because we've perfected our capability.
Okay. That can't be true, but that's what he said, right?
That's what he said. Three explanations. One is that minor reliable systems are good enough for the North Koreans. They don't need to have everything work perfectly. They just have to have a capability to threaten us, and that's enough.
Right.
That's one explanation. Second explanation is that he was lying to his people to give him wiggle room so he could cut a deal with the United States.
Oh, saying, that's interesting. Okay. Saying
that we'll,
so it was for domestic purposes.
For domestic purposes.
Okay.
Third explanation is that his technicians, scientists, and generals lied to him.
Of course.
Because if he said, I want to have a capability to do this, they're not going to say, no, sir, it's not reliable, it's not good enough yet.
Right.
So which of
them... So he may believe that he has it even when
possibly,
he doesn't.
Possibly.
So how would that affect then, if we know he doesn't, how does that affect the next round of negotiations?
Well, this is why keep your eyes on those photographs.
Got it.
Because
they
might be saying they're just signaling, but they're pretty comfortable with their capability, in which case if we make some kind of limited offer of sanctions release, they might say, no, we'll cut back.
Right.
If, however, they're not confident about it or think they really do need to test, then this is going to get dangerous.
And that could ramp up tensions. And well, let's come back to your kind of overall assessment of the president's negotiating style, right? Because early on, it felt like we were marching towards war, and that's what he told us. And then we pivoted hard into this negotiating phase, unprecedented. I guess there's a good news and bad news there. The good news is that he's capable of pivoting. The bad news is that he's capable of pivoting, you know, and now he can might pivot to this opposite
He's capable
direction.
Of pivoting back.
Right. How concerned are you about that?
I'm less concerned now than I was in 2017 before he had the initial pivot, in part because I think the fact that he's talked about falling in love with Kim Jong-un and I've met him, all of that makes it a little bit less likely that he could feel that he can make the same kinds of threatening comments.
Okay.
But remember, the president is somebody who really surprises us and enjoys surprising people, enjoys being
in many different domains, right?
Yeah.
Good point.
Absolutely. So it's certainly possible that he could go back to making those kinds of threats. And I think the gravest danger is that some kind of mixture of threatened preventive war or a limited attack combined with some kind of accident get out of control.
Right.
And this is a scenario I worry about.
Okay, go through it.
We've talked about this once or twice before. And
by the way, everybody, Professor Sagan's written about these things for many, many years. Limits of Safety, I think, is one of your books, right, Scott?
That is correct.
So remind everybody why you need to be concerned generally and then tell us of
well,
your
let me
worst
give you,
case scenario.
Well, let me. This is not a worst case. This is a case that happened to us. And the worst case is to imagine it, the same thing happening to North Korea. So listeners might remember that a year ago or so, we had an incident in Hawaii where a radar warning system, people who do the emergency broadcasting systems, did a practice of what an attack would be like and issued a warning but said, this is not a test. This is not a test.
Right.
A missile is coming in. Some people panicked in Hawaii. Some people did the right thing, which is to go into your basement if you have one, or into the middle of the house if you have one. The bad thing is to go out and be outside where radiation and fallout is more likely to get to you. But in Washington or in Omaha, where the Strategic Command is, or in Colorado Springs, where the North American Air Defense Command is, no one panicked at all. Why? Well, one, because we have redundant warning systems, and none of them said that a missile has been launched at Hawaii.
Okay.
Two, we have reliable and professional officers who said, we screwed up. This was a mistake. And three, we didn't really think North Korea was about to attack Hawaii.
Right.
Here's the imaginary scenario. Imagine that that happens in North Korea tomorrow. Well, first off, they don't have a lot of redundant warning systems. They rely on old, primitive radars.
Okay.
Two, instead of having professional warning operators, they've got yes men who have to be really worried that if they make a mistake, they don't say, Chairman Kim, I just screwed up. They get out of there. They run because you're likely to get killed rather than fired if you make a mistake like that.
In that system, yeah.
And three, I would worry that while we didn't think Kim Jong-un was about to attack Hawaii, they sometimes worry that we might attack them.
Right.
And with good reason, because we talk about it sometimes.
We talk about it.
So this is why I'm a little less worried now, because the fact that the president says, I love Kim Jong-un, he's a good guy, I understand him, that makes it less likely both that he would take an action, but it also makes it less likely that if there's an accidental or a false warning, that Kim Jong-un would interpret this as an attack. You want to create a different set of expectations.
Right.
But that could easily reverse because the president could pivot back.
Right. And he is known to do that in other places. Well, let's talk a little bit about that. Presumably, the president of the United States can't launch a nuclear war against another country without some checks in the systems. But maybe that isn't the right presumption. Tell us what it would take. And in particular, I know, Scott, you've done some new research about American attitudes towards such a strike. I think some of us take some comfort in believing that the American people wouldn't support that. Tell us what your data shows.
Well, first let's talk about how the system works in terms of the command and control system, and then we'll talk about the polling
societal data. Stuff. Right. Perfect.
We have very few checks and balances on presidents' ability to launch nuclear weapons. During the Cold War, this current system was set up because we felt that the president needed to make a very quick decision on a moment's notice. There's a reason why the ICBMs are called Minutemen, because they can launch in minutes.
You know, I've been reading about Minutemen forever, and that's the first time I understood why they're called that.
That's why they named them. Okay. It was a nice appeal to people in Massachusetts and the memory of the Revolutionary War, but that was a cool way that they can be launched in minutes, right? And the president has, following him, an officer with the codes, with the different attack options that are presented.
Right.
And he can, if a warning comes in, tell the person to contact the Strategic Command and bring the Secretary of Defense on the line. Sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't, depending on how much time you have.
Okay.
The president can issue the order. And he could start that by going to the officer with the football and say, I want you to contact STRATCOM right away, and I want to issue the following set of orders. Now, it does not require the Secretary of Defense to have a decision on it. It doesn't require the Attorney General. Matt Waxman and Dick Betts from Columbia have proposed that the Secretary of Defense and the Attorney General be put in the chain of command, a proposal that I would fully endorse, but one that has not been enacted.
That would have to be a law, right, in order to make it happen? Or could
no,
it be an executive
I don't,
order?
It would have to be an executive order because the law would run against potential constitutional violations.
Okay.
Because the commander-in-chief should be able to order in an emergency a decision to use force. So this would be a very interesting question. There have been some laws that Representative Ted Lieu and Senator Ed Markey have proposed to make some changes in this direction. They've got some people signing on, but it could be a very interesting constitutional battle. Now, because of Donald Trump's statements that he's made, fire and fury and concerns that his decision-making will not be entirely reasonable, the Senate had hearings on whether the president should have sole authority. And after that hearing, STRATCOM Commander John Hyten publicly said, well, if the president issued an illegal order, I wouldn't follow it. I would say, sir, that's an illegal order, and I won't follow that. We've been trained not to follow illegal orders. And do you know what I'd say, the commander of STRATCOM said? I would say, sir, here are some military options that would be legitimate and legal attacks that could serve your purpose.
Okay.
So
did he define legal?
Well, he has JAG officers, Judge Advocate General officers, who have looked at all the options in the war plan
And
have tweaked them so that they would be legal.
I see.
Now, many people found Huyton's comments reassuring. I didn't, for two reasons. One is that I believe that what General Huyton was referring to was the jus in bello, the legality of different kinds of targeting once a war begins.
Okay.
And there he's right, that he has specific options that have been deemed to target legal targets. And he could tell the president, here are some things that you could do that would be legal. Now, I know enough about that process to know that there's some concerns. For example, STRATCOM, as does the rest of the Department of Defense, says that a military target is not just one that's used for a military purpose today, but one that could be used in the future. And the example that they give is a civilian airport. So they say it is a legitimate military target for us to attack a civilian airport because you could put military planes on that airport.
Oh, I see. Okay. Right? All right.
So if Donald Trump said, I want you to destroy the center of Pyongyang, I do believe that General Huyton would say, sir, that's an illegal order. I will not follow that. But he could, he never said this, but theoretically he could say, we could hit the airport and that would be illegal, or we could hit the Ministry of Defense and that would be a legal attack. Now, its effects on the people of Pyongyang would be relatively the same.
Exactly, I see. Right.
That's one reason not to be reassured. The other reason not to be reassured by General Huyton's comments is that he's not really talking about initiating a war. In fact, we don't want our military to make judgments. We want our civilians to make that.
Right, right.
So if the president, without reason, said, I want you to start a war, the military almost always salutes and says, that's your job. That's above my pay grade.
Right.
So it is at least possible that the president could issue an illegal order about starting a war of aggression, and the military would not feel that that was their role to stop that.
Right. And then you're going to tell us about the societal constraints or the lack thereof.
Well, there are some constraints. Professor Ben Valentino at Dartmouth and I conducted a poll in February 2019, just before the Hanoi summit, of 3,000 Americans, a representative sample of the American public, about the conditions under which they would support or not support the use of force against North Korea.
Okay. Interesting.
Some good news, some bad news. First, one big piece of good news is that the American public is reluctant to start a war. We tried lots of different manipulations by giving people different kinds of information about the likelihood of success, the casualties in the United States or the casualties in North Korea. And under every one of the scenarios that we laid out, there was no majority support for initiating a war.
Okay, that's good news.
That is good news.
Glad to hear that.
That is good news. Bad news is that in a scenario where we said they tested missiles, should we launch a nuclear first strike against them, 33% of the American public said that they agreed with that.
In response to a test.
In response to a test. 67% said no. So this is like a glass one-third empty, two-thirds full. So there's some good news there that the strong majority said, no, don't do that. But it is pretty disturbing that 33% of the public would start a nuclear war. And I think that rather there being a nuclear taboo, that there's very little evidence of a nuclear taboo. I think what there is evidence of some reluctance to use nuclear weapons, but among a minority opinion, there are some who actually think it's not a bad idea, especially against people that they have hostile feelings towards.
Right. That's pretty shocking to me.
Yeah.
That's a big number to me. Yeah. And it also sounds pretty close to the core supporters of the president right now. We don't know that, of course, but, you know, that's the group that he cares about for all other policy issues. He's not concerned about getting to majorities.
None of this polling data suggests the American public has learned to love the bomb and stop worrying.
Right.
They worry about accidents or something going wrong.
Right.
And they still don't trust Kim Jong-un.
Right.
In our polls, only 10% of the American public said yes when asked, do you have high confidence that Kim Jong-un will make rational decisions about the use of force? Only 10%.
10%.
It's not particularly reassuring, however, that 45%, only 45% of the public said that about Donald Trump.
45%.
Yeah, so a significant majority of Republicans say that they have trust in the president's rational decision-making about using force. A very small percentage of Democrats believe the president makes decisions about use of force in a rational manner.
That's pretty sobering. So maybe the last question, I mean, how does time figure into these negotiations, right? The president kept saying in Hanoi, we got a lot of time, I'm in no rush, we got a lot of time. But there might be a scenario in which he doesn't have very much time at all. If he's down in the polls come next summer and he's thinking about he might just be a one-term president, how does that play? I can think of different scenarios. How might it play in these negotiations with the North Koreans?
I do worry that as a president, if he is down in the polls and if he's making threats might get some applause. We find that both among that minority group that actually doesn't mind nuclear weapons use as pugnacious and ill-informed, they might support something. And we do know that there's a rally around the flag effect, that Americans think my country's got right or wrong, and even if I disagree with this decision, I'll support them. The thing that the president needs to know is the rally around the flag effect is very, very short-lived.
Interesting.
And how long it lasts depends in part on how successful the military operation
is. Okay, that makes sense.
I believe that a military campaign against North Korea, while I think the United States will win, I think it will be devastating to South Korea, most likely to portions of the United States, and certainly to the 28,500 American soldiers that we have there and the 200,000 American civilians who live in Seoul and surrounding areas on any given day of the year.
Right.
So I think, while I worry about this phenomenon, I think what we need to try to keep in the public mind is that a war in North Korea and South Korea is going to affect Americans, and it's not going to turn out well. And let's continue to either give diplomacy a chance, and if it doesn't work, then let's practice deterrence and containment. It worked with the Soviet Union, and it could work, I think, with North Korea.
Well, I completely agree. And thank you, Scott, for all you do to try to educate the debate along those lines, because the cataclysmic alternatives, I think, are not well understood. And thanks for doing that here on World Class as well today. Appreciate you being here.
Great pleasure to be here, Mike.
You've been listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. If you liked this episode, please review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps new listeners to find the show. And be sure to subscribe to stay up to date on what's happening in the world and why.